Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 256. The British have just suffered their greatest defeat in their colonial history at the Battle of Isandlwana, and the bodies of 1,400 officers and men lay scattered across a gory battlefield. Then, along the paths to the west, towards the Mzinyathi River and Rorke's Drift. Lord Chelmsford, who had scurried off to the east in support of Major Dartnell, only made it back to the slopes of Isandlwana at dusk on the day of the 22nd of January, 1879. As the nervous British soldiers advanced, they could see dense masses of Zulus retiring with herds of cattle in wagons up on the skyline to their right. About 800 metres from Isandlwana battle site, they stopped and formed into a line. The guns were in the centre of the road, with three companies of British infantry, a Natal native contingent battalion, and a portion of cavalry on each flank. The mounted police were in reserve. Chelmsford ordered the guns to fire on the neck of Isandlwana, while Major Wilson Black advanced up the right to seize a kopje overlooking the battlefield that the British named Black's Kopje. It was around 7 p.m. Black signalled the main force to advance, and Captain Harford, who marched up with the 2nd and 3rd Natal Native Contingent, noticed the grass had been trampled flat and smooth by the size of the Zulu army. Soon they began to stumble as they tripped over bodies, and Harford admitted later, "Nothing on earth could make those who were armed with rifles to keep their place in the front rank, and the curses showered on them by the officers could not prevent them from closing in and making up in clumps." The darkness spared the soldiers the magnitude of the disaster, but not the details. Captain Penn Simons reported later that they constantly stumbled over naked, gashed, and ghastly bodies of our late comrades. The Zulu opened up the bowels of the dead to allow the soul to depart, but to the English eye this was an act of desecration of a body. "After killing them," said Kompega Twabe, one of the warriors later, "we used to split them up the stomach so that their bodies would not swell." Zulu traditional belief recognized the frustration of gases produced by a decomposing body as the spirit of the man unable to leave its earthly form. If the killer did not open the stomach, the spirit's wrath would attach to him, and he would suffer all manner of misfortunes. His own body might swell like a corpse, and eventually he would be driven mad. Often echelons of warriors after battle would be dispatched to carry out the ritual disemboweling, hlomulaing the dead after removing their clothes and weapons. They left the trousers, taking just the jackets, and if some were bloody, they would leave these too. Body parts of men who had fallen bravely in battle were a potent form of war medicine. Some strips of skin from the breastbone, facial hair, the right forearm, the forehead, beards were removed by some to be used by the specialized Izinyanga to prepare the Amabuto for future campaigns. They were going to provide a supernatural ascendancy over the British when they next met in battle, they hoped. Earlier, before Chelmsford had arrived, the Zulus had turned up a few British soldiers who were feigning death. Umorti of the Ukanampemvu was eating sugar he'd found when he was startled by a shot from the slopes nearby. A soldier, who'd been lying there and seeing a Zulu approach, fired and killed him, then made a run for it, but he was soon overtaken and speared. By far the most traumatic discovery that evening was made by Colonel Henry Degache of the 2nd and 24th. Whose brother William had commanded the 1st and 24th during the battle. In the gloom, Degache almost rode over his brother's body. "I did not feel it much," he wrote later, "for I never expected to see daylight and said to old boy, I shall be with you in half an hour." The entire column felt their lives would end any minute. The troops bivouacked in a large hollow square on the saddle of Isandlwana, with the guns and horses in the centre. Colonel Black's men remained on the summit of the kopje. It was a cold night, despite being midsummer, wet, and on the hills around, They could see hundreds of Zulu campfires. Through the night, they also saw flashes of light from the direction of Rorke's Drift, and the sound of firing drifted faintly on the katabatic wind. Chelmsford visited Harford and his NNC during the night and asked if they thought the Zulus would attack again. Harford said yes. He could not know that the main Zulu army was exhausted. They had also taken terrible casualties and were in no mood to continue battling the British. As I mentioned last episode, some warriors left immediately. Most remained in the area for 3 days, though, waiting for many of their wounded as possible to recover sufficiently for the march of over 100 kilometres back to their homes. Chelmsford, however, had made up his mind to abandon the camp before dawn the next morning. Later, he would be condemned for not staying long enough to bury his dead and salvage what he could from the wrecked camp. What critics would gloss over was the fact that his army was also in a terrible shape. They had no spare ammunition. All had been seized by the Zulu. The main depot was Rorke's Drift. They had no food, only a few biscuits. Some of his men had not eaten for 48 hours. All had marched more than 40 kilometres in 24 hours. None were in any state for any sort of exertion. The smells of war are always the most visceral and the most telling. The sights, the sounds are tough, but it's the smells that get you. That night, as his column of 1,724th Battalion survivors, Natal Native Contingent, and Colonial Mounted Troops bivouacked, the odour of death and destruction seeped into their consciousness. Meanwhile, the victorious Zulu army bivouacked across the Inyoni Heights in the Ngwebeni Valley, close by. We need to delve a little more deeply into the story right now of some of the survivors of the battle, including the much-hyped tale of how Lieutenants Coggle and Melville reportedly tried to save the battalion colours. This is part of the myth of Isandlwana, drilled into the Victorian mind with its infatuation with death or glory. In the days before the 22nd of January 1879, both Neville Josiah Alma Coggle and Teignmouth Melville managed to attract unwanted attention, not for gallantry, but for indiscipline. While moving through the Isandlwana area, they entered an abandoned Zulu umuzi and attempted to seize a pair of chickens. This was explicitly against standing orders. Chelmsford's instructions were clear. Non-combatant property was not to be looted, both for moral reasons and to avoid inflaming local hostility. They were caught, rebuked, and formally reported. Coggle had fallen from his horse during the caper and dislocated his knee. The matter did not proceed to a full court-martial, but both officers were severely reprimanded and temporarily removed from favour. Their reputation suffered, particularly damaging in a Victorian officer corps where honour and propriety mattered enormously. Fast forward to the battle itself and the aftermath. On the 22nd of January 1879, during the Battle of Isandlwana, both men were present in the doomed British camp. Melville was adjutant of the 1st and 24th Regiment, responsible for paperwork, orders, and the Queen's colour. Coghill served as staff officer and transport officer despite being injured. He had a badly damaged knee, making it painful for him to ride. As the Zulu attack overwhelmed the camp and command collapsed, the senior surviving officers recognised that the Queen's colour must not be captured. To lose it would be an intolerable disgrace. Melville grabbed the staff and attempted to escape. Coghill, seeing this, chose to accompany him, despite knowing that his injury made flight extremely dangerous. Perhaps it was also his ticket out. Let's see. The story goes that the two men rode together through the chaos pursued by Zulu warriors, eventually reaching the Imzinyati River at what later became known as Fugitive's Drift. There, catastrophe struck again. Melville's horse lost footing in the flood-swollen river. The colours slipped into the water. Coghill dismounted to help him, hobbling on his wounded knee. Together, they recovered the colour, but by then it was too late. Zulu warriors had closed in. Both men were killed on the Natal bank, within yards of safety. Their bodies were found later near one another. The colour was recovered downstream days later. But wait, there's a problem with that version. Historian Saul David has reminded us that they were the only officers of the 1st and 24th Regiment to survive. All the rest perished with their fellow soldiers. He and other military historians who have studied the records believe Melville was taking the colours as an excuse to make a quick getaway. The story is further embellished by Lieutenant Walter Higginson, who inserted himself into the tale. When the two arrived at the river, he spun a story about trying to save both British soldiers and the colours, but failed. Trooper Walwyn Walker of the Natal Carbineers has a slightly different version, and he was an eyewitness on the scene. He had galloped away from the battle and crossed the river under covering fire from a section of Zikali's horse. These were the black mounted soldiers who rode alongside the colonials and the British who were on the Natal side of the Imzinyati River, supporting his crossing. Lieutenant Walter Higginson, bedraggled, staggered out of the river nearby. This was shortly after he said he tried to save Coggle and Melville and the colours. Barker's horse was exhausted, so the Natal colonial told Higginson he should ride his horse to the top of the river bank and wait for him there. Instead, Higginson hightailed it away, leaving the Carbineer stranded and now being hunted down by Zulu warriors. Luckily for Barker, more than 2 kilometres down the trail, Higginson came across other Natal Carbineers who recognised Barker's horse. They gave Higginson a Basutu pony, then rode back to look for Barker with his steed. When they found Barker, he had run over 4 kilometres to try and escape the Zulu warriors. He was exhausted, angry, but relieved. When Barker confronted Higginson later, he broke down and cried, claiming he could not have walked any further, and that at some point he would have sent his horse back for him. Higginson was seen later at Help Makar inside Transvaal territory with a black eye, handed out by Barker, no doubt. His suspect version of events have cast a shadow on the story of Coggle and Melville. Higginson wrote a report for Lord Chelmsford in February, and so convincing was his account that the Duke of Cambridge no less suggested Higginson receive a Victoria Cross for assisting Melville and Coggle. The hint was not taken up by Lord Chelmsford, possibly because he knew the truth. In a complete contrast to Higginson's disgraceful behaviour is the story of 22-year-old Private Samuel Wassell of the 80th Regiment. He was not assigned to any duty on the 22nd of January, and in his shirt sleeves made his escape on a Basutu pony and was halfway across the raging Imzinyati in full flood when he heard a shout of terror. Private Westwood was trapped behind him in a whirlpool. Wassell turned midstream, swimming back to the Zululand bank, tied up his horse, saved Westwood with a branch. The pair mounted Wassell's pony, and in a hail of Zulu bullets, they managed to reach the Natal bank safely. No Victoria Cross for Wassell. At least they survived, along with 455 others, 55 British soldiers, and 350 Natal native contingent auxiliaries. In an interesting aside, only 5 officers lived to tell the tale of Isandlwana, and all these survivors wore blue patrol jackets, not red jackets like the other officers. No officer in scarlet tunic survived, partly because they were more conspicuous, but also because Tetshwayo Kampande had told his warriors to concentrate on the British redcoats, reminding them that the civilians wore blue and black. Coggle had also donned a blue patrol jacket before fleeing, but even that didn't save him in the end. The last soldier to die at Isandlwana was a redcoat private who took refuge high on the south side of the mountain inside a small cave. It was above a shelf where C Company had been wiped out, so we presume he was of that company. Every Zulu warrior who tried to approach the entrance was shot. Eventually, the Zulu formed up and let loose an entire volley into the cave, and resistance was snuffed out. Months later, the soldier's skeleton was found 50 metres below the cave, a rope tied around his neck. Bones never lie. We return to Isandlwana Neck on the evening of the 22nd. Here, Chelmsford's surviving troops camped alongside the battlefield. An apocalyptic night, survivors described how surreal it was. the horror of the situation, dark with fear. They were surrounded by death, thousands of British and Zulu dead, as well as oxen, mules, horses, dogs. Terrible events took place that night, as soldiers stumbled into cadavers, their nerves stretched tight by hunger and exhaustion. The overwhelming presence of the dead, all the more terrible because they could not be seen, lying just out of arm's length away in the inky blackness, their stiff, cold limbs ready to snag and trip the unwary. That night it rained. The next morning troops realized they'd laid their cloaks out on blood-soaked soil. Red gore mud covered their clothes, along with the odor of blood. A mounted infantryman told Penn Simons that he'd looked for a drink of water during the night and came across someone lying nearby. He nudged him and said, "Got a drink in your water bottle, mate?" No reply. He felt for the bottle but discovered the man had been disemboweled. The experience changed all their lives, particularly a young trooper of the Mounted Police, James Walker. After the war, James would be sent home to spend his days in a London mental institution. During the night, British and Zulu warriors had come across each other, bumped into each other. Some drunken Zulu on one of the wagons had been bayoneted, too motherless to escape. The soldiers from both sides exchanged words, cursing each other in a language neither could understand, but the meanings were inescapable. It's a bizarre nature of this crucial event in South African history, a battle that was also going to lead to the collapse of the Disraeli government. That political effect is for a future podcast, but imagine how, in the dark Zululand summer night, soldiers from two armies prodded each other in complete darkness, or the flickering half-light of a weak fire. For the Zulu, their own dead and wounded needed attention, but they were spread across a great arc many kilometers long. It was necessary to give the bodies a token burial. Scores were tipped into underground grain pits and dongas. Fragments of the bones of these continue to be washed out well into recent times. The Zulu list of important men killed was long, and their relatives did their best to locate their bodies. Inkosi Mkosana Kamvundlana, for example, he was found in a shield placed over his body after his stomach was opened to release his spirit. One of Inkosi Mnyamana Mbutulezi's sons, Mtumingana, also died. He was buried by his brother, Mkandumba. Others who died include Sikodi Ka Masipula, whose father had been a senior counselor to King Mpande, and Mzika Manyozi, whose father had been an Inkawe and a great favorite of King Shaka. Sigodi's brother was seriously wounded. So too the sons of Zulu commander Inshingwayo. Manzi Ka Choda was dead. It was he who had set off the entire battle chanting, "Lightning of Heaven!" among the Ingoba Makosi. Mlambula Matibula lay critically wounded, no pain relief, shot four times during the battle. He was a few hundred meters from where the British column camped for the night, stuffing moss into his bleeding bullet wounds, then binding these with grass. He survived. The range of wounds inflicted by British firepower was catastrophic. The Martini Henry round splintered bones and shattered joints, sometimes blew off arms and sometimes legs. Dozens would drag themselves off the field of battle and by some miracle survive on the veldt, found later by other Zulu and nursed back to health. While men on both sides of Inyoni Ridge never managed to sleep that night, others were so exhausted they fell asleep almost immediately, missing their first meal in 2 days for the British, bully beef and biscuits. Theophilus Shepston Jr. angered the British regulars by shaking hands with everyone and saying goodbye. "For we shall never see the sunrise again," he said in a quivering voice. Simon sneered at the colonial's histrionics. Nearby, Major Black on his kopi, or Matlaba Mkosi, as it was known, was barking orders. "Don't shoot, boys. Cold steel is our motto." All that Chelmsford knew of the whereabouts and intentions of his victorious enemy was that some at least lay between his command and the Natal border, and the only route to salvation. He had no idea of the incredible saga playing out at Rorke's Drift that very moment. It is to Rorke's Drift we now turn, for these two battles, Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift, are really part of the same moment in time. Rorke's Drift has its own epic mythology, and the ending, unlike the Sandliner, was a British victory. It was, however, a Pyrrhic victory, because Chelmsford had to withdraw from the territory anyway, not to mention Pyrrhic, because it finally convinced the British commander to adopt the tactics he'd been advised to by the Boers. By using the laager method of defence against overwhelming numbers of motivated warriors. So we turn back the clock to the 22nd of January. It's midday, a languid day, summer in all its Zululand glory. Christmas beetles rasping, the heat and humidity cloaking the hills. Activity preferably slow and steady to avoid exhaustion. The Imzinyati Valley near Shiani Hill was deserted after Chelmsford's tent army had moved on to Sandliwana. The nights with the croaking frogs, the nightjars, sometimes a hyena or wild dog, interspersed with the sentries sounding off. All that remained now was Lieutenant John Chard's solitary camp, two little tents beside a deep pool where the pont was moored, and about a kilometre away at the foot of the Shiani Hill, a clutch of white tents at Jim Rourke's old storehouse. Lieutenant Chard was eating lunch under a tree near the pool, writing letters home. At Rourke's Drift storehouse, Lieutenant Bromhead and Assistant Commissary Walter Dunn dined together in the shade of an awning stretched between two tent poles. They were in charge of the massive stockpile of supplies at the post. The convoys of wagons would be transporting these east following Chelmsford's army. It was about this time that the handful of men at Rourke's Drift began to pick up something was afoot. They lay between the jump-off point of Halp Mekaar and Isandlwana. They had no idea what had just happened there. Missionary Otto Witt had leased his property, Rourke's Drift storehouse and buildings, to the British military in December 1878. It had been converted into a staging post for supplies and where the sick and wounded would be transported to recover. Trader Jim Rourke had constructed the buildings. When he died, the property was sold to two settler families, the Stockels and the Surtees. They had walled up some of the internal doors to provide privacy for the two families under the same roof, and this was going to doom many of the men who would not be able to escape from Zulu warriors in the coming night's battle. The house was in use as the centre column's base hospital, and about 30 sick were joined by two men wounded during the attack on Sihayo's homestead. They lay on simple straw mattresses, on top of rows of planks, on top of bricks. Otto Witt sent his family into Msinga for safety, but remained behind to keep an eye on the British, living in a tent nearby, which he was sharing with his Swedish friend, August Hamar. As historian Ian Knight points out, Hamar had arrived with impeccable timing only a few days before. Missionary Witt had been using Rourke's barn-like store as a church, but the British returned it to its original purpose. It was packed to the rafters with supplies. Luckily for the men at Rourke's Drift, Transport Commander Smith Dorrien had been unable to collect these supplies that morning because it was the 90-kilogram sacks of corn, heavy wooden boxes, 70 centimetres square, full of coarse biscuits and tinned meat rations that were going to stop thousands of Zulu bullets during the night. Two vast pyramids of goods were piled on the veranda. All of these ready-made sandbags were going to be deployed in the coming hours, just in time from the British point of view, as you'll hear next episode. The Battle of Rourke's Drift would be a desperate improvised stand in which a handful of British soldiers, reeling from the disaster of Sandliwana, held a mission station against overwhelming odds and salvaged imperial honour in the space of a single night. It would also spawn a multitude of myths, but what happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about episodes. You can also email me from there and sign up for a newsletter. Until next, tot ziens.